Hello, you're listening to the Drawing the Ideal Self podcast for July 2022. So, having watched Wimbledon and a few other things going on in the UK, like the Commonwealth Games, I thought it might be quite interesting to have a think about some things to do with sport and maybe sport coaching or self-coaching. And as always with PCP, you know, coaching applies to anything at all. The principles will be the same. So if you're trying to help somebody improve their reading, you're still coaching. The key is about how you help them to think about their performance and how they might be able to improve it. And this has come about not only because of, you know, what's going on and the fact that I did watch Wimbledon this year, because I am trying to learn to play tennis better. And I'm really not very good, but I can see some progress. There's a BBC radio programme on BBC Radio 4, which is called The Expectation Effect by David Robson. It's actually a shortened version of a book, which is called the same name, but it's about how your brain can change your world for the better. When I listened to it, I thought, actually, it's all PCP, because it's all about the expectations and how they can affect our behaviour and our outcomes, and obviously that's about how we construe things. And there's an episode on there, it's called Faster, Stronger, Fitter, How to Take the Pain Out of Exercise, and I'll put the link to this show in the show notes. It's not the only one that's relevant to any kind of exercise and trying to improve things. There's one about willpower, there's one about de-stressing stress, there's also one about the food paradox. Can our minds affect our waistlines? And then there's another one called Super Ages, which is relevant to me. Are you as young or old as you feel? And as I'm getting older, this is very relevant. It's a show that's really worth listening to because it covers quite a wide range of subjects. And the key to all of it is how the way we anticipate our experiences can affect how we experience them. One of the things he talks about was people in a war zone having to have operations and they didn't have anaesthetics. So what they did was get a nurse to inject a saline solution so it didn't do any harm and tell the patient that they were having an anaesthetic. And the person who arranged this, the doctor, reckoned it was about 90% effective. Oh my word, that's incredible. So the power of the way that we see the world and our expectations or our anticipations in PCP thinking really makes a huge difference. And that's very encouraging because it means that we can change things for ourselves by changing our anticipations. So the other thing that I have done is read most of a book called Sports Psychology in Action, and it's by Richard J. Butler. It's actually quite an old book. It was published in 1996, so it's pretty old, but actually there aren't many things that you can read about PCP and sports coaching or sports performance. So it's a very good book, and if you're interested in improving your performance in any kind of sport, it's got lots of exercises that you could do, or if you're interested in coaching people. So useful for both of those. And Richard Butler was a clinical psychologist. So what I thought we could look at in particular is a couple of things, and the first one of those is about self-belief, and I'll read you what he says about self-belief. So self-belief can be regarded synonymously with confidence. It is the individual's awareness of his ability to undertake a task. He goes on to say, it can thus be conceptualized as an aspect of self-awareness, which postulates two descriptive and two evaluative facets of self-concept. So these facets of self-concept are self-image, self-esteem, self-vulnerability and self-belief. And he talks about what each of those does. So self-belief acknowledges the following things as important. It's an estimate of effectiveness, which may range from certainty, highly confident, to uncertainty, lacking in confidence. It's ability, which may be present or not. Thus, an individual may be just as certain, in brackets confident, of not having the ability to complete a task successfully as another individual who is certain of his ability. I think that's interesting in itself. So, if from the point of view of having a go at any sport, you might enter it thinking, oh yeah, I'll be able to do this because I've done something similar before. You might enter it thinking, I have no good at ball skills, for instance, so this is not going to be something I can do. But both of those extremes will affect your self-belief. And then there's confidence, which is evaluated in relation to a task. This task may be at a micro level, so a footballer may be confident of scoring a penalty, the task, by blasting it, but not confident about scoring by placing it in the corner. Alternatively, the task may be at a more macro level, where confidence about a complete performance, e.g. an ice skating programme, a bowling performance or a slalom course, is evaluated. And then there's the outcome, which is defined in terms of whether the athlete will accomplish the task successfully. He goes on to say two theoretical models have influenced opinion on the subject of confidence. The least well-known, which is the one I'm particularly interested in, of course, is the goodness of fit model postulated by Mildred McCoy, 1977, who in taking a personal construct perspective argued that self-belief is an awareness of how well a person will match up to the task before them. Where there is a goodness of fit between how the person expects to perform and how they will actually perform, then the individual will experience confidence. Where there is a discrepancy between the expectation and performance, the person experiences guilt. They have behaved in a way they would not have anticipated of themselves. Note this model equally describes a person's lack of confidence in goodness of fit terms as it does a person's sense of confidence. So it's about how well our expectations fit with our experience. Now, this suggests that if we're going to help somebody improve their performance, we need to be very aware of how they see themselves coming into the task. What are their anticipations? Do they think they're already good at the task? Or do they feel that they're absolutely hopeless at it and therefore won't be able to do it at all? So I've done some work with children where their reading is really not coming on. The way they anticipate an experience of another reading task is that it's going to be more evidence that they're no good at reading. So when they approach it, they have feelings maybe of panic. You know, in PCP terms, they'd be anxious. They might actually experience fear or threat if it's a big deal thing. So it can be very, very powerful to look at those things in advance of a task. That will enable you to talk to the person and say, okay, so did it go as well as you expected? Did you think that the way you, for instance, jumped over that hurdle really was the best that you could do? Or do you think there's a gap and you can improve your performance somehow or another? Butler also says that there's another big model that's important in this, and that's Bandura's self-efficacy. So he says that Bandura distinguished between an outcome expectancy, described as the person's estimate that a given behaviour will lead to a certain outcome, from an efficacy expectation, which he contended was the person's estimate about whether they could successfully execute the behaviour required to produce the outcome. So Bandura suggested confidence is an estimate of how effective the person considers they will be in undertaking the task. Expectations of efficacy will determine whether the behaviour will be initiated, how much effort will be expended, and how long it will be sustained. Success, it is argued, will increase the strength of self-efficacy and failure will decrease the estimate of efficacy. So Butler says, if you take together the goodness of fit of McCoy and Bandura's model, then you have an integrated model of confidence. So faced with a task, the person first estimates how effective he will be in completing the task. So even before you start the task, somebody will be anticipating how well it's going to go. Sometimes when I serve in tennis, I'll throw the ball up and after I've hit it, I think, I don't know why I hit that. At some level, I knew that was not going to go over the net. So I'm getting better at some awareness of when it's not going to go over the net. However, what I haven't learned to do yet is to catch that ball and throw it again. And the throw was the thing that had spoilt the shot. So I'd thrown it behind me slightly or too wide for me to hit it well. What I couldn't do at the very beginning was have any idea about that. So I've had to have somebody point out where you throw the ball up, how high you throw the ball up, how fast you throw the ball up before I can try and improve my performance. So in the outcome of doing something in a sport, in this example, but it could be anything, the first thing that happens is the estimate of efficacy is validated or invalidated. So he says that you can either meet it with success or you can meet it with the anticipation of failure and then the expected failure. So here there's a goodness of fit between expectation and outcome, resulting in confirmation of ability. This sense of mastery strengthens self-belief. Now that can be really unhelpful if that self-belief is that you can't do things. I think it's interesting the Couch to 5K, which some of you might have done, takes people in very small steps towards being able to run 5K. And I know many people who've started like that and then they've absolutely become runners and are running long distances now when they couldn't even run 100 yards at the very beginning. So getting the steps right enables you to help the person to validate a belief that maybe they have some ability in this area. Just maybe. That's enough to get started. And that could be the case. You know, if you think about reading schemes, that's why the beginnings of reading schemes are so easy. They don't have many words. So the chance of success is extremely high. So even if somebody comes in with the expectation they won't be able to read, the likelihood is by the end of reading book one, they will be able to read something. So you're immediately building that sense of self as somebody who is a reader. The same applies to the Couch to 5K. So you're developing that expectation that you are able to be a runner. Now, another thing that can happen, Butler says, is the estimate of efficacy is invalidated, leading to hostility where the outcome is uncommon. So hostility from a PCP perspective is the individual's effort to protect the view they have of themselves despite evidence to the contrary. It may appear as an effort to tamper with the evidence. There will be a tendency to rationalise, excuse, or explain why the performance or outcome was different to what was expected. Thus, the archer who scores lower than he expects may put this down to poor conditions, a bad draw, or a new piece of equipment. The hostility preserves belief in his ability. On the other hand, the novice golfer who chips a shot to the green, which exceeds all his expectations, might rationalise it as beginner's luck. This again would be a hostile reaction because it confirms the view that he does not have the ability to perform the shot consistently, and thus a lack of belief in his ability is confirmed. And this is where it can link with the anticipation of an experience. So if I am playing tennis and playing at the net, which is probably my least favourite place to be, one, because you might get smashed in the face with the ball, but the other is because I'm not quick at all. But every time a shot is missed, I think, yes, I'm not good at playing at the net. So what I've tried to do recently is to think, I am someone who is learning to play at the net rather than someone who can't play at the net at all. And that is shifting something about the way I feel when I'm there. It doesn't mean that I'm necessarily any better at it, but I am intentionally learning, I think, and noticing what works and what doesn't work in a different kind of way. Whereas before I had a kind of a blanket approach of thinking, I hate being here, I'm really a bit scared, and all I'm going to do is miss, and then my partner's going to feel irritated with that because I don't know what to do. I don't know whether to go for the ball or not. And I think what I wasn't doing before was thinking, okay, that's worked. I wonder if I can repeat that and notice what worked about it. So when I'm in that situation again, I can try it and see if it will work again. I've tried to think about where I might put a shot. And one of the ways I've done this is actually by watching tennis matches, which I've never really done in any big way before. I've watched more of Wimbledon this year than I ever had before, because I am actually actively trying to learn. I think that is related to my age and thinking, if I don't learn now, it's going to be too late. I need to get on with it. There's no time to waste. So that kind of hostility is about invalidating and pretending to yourself that you haven't invalidated. So increasing your awareness of your theories about your own performance actually is quite helpful. And that would apply to any sport, but also any activity. If you're wanting to become a better chef and you're starting with chopping up vegetables, you know, understanding why and how you might cut your fingers with a very sharp knife if you do it quickly is going to be quite important. But thinking, you know, I will always cut my fingers isn't at all a helpful sort of way to approach it. For me, some of this goes back to the idea that change is actually really difficult. So it is always easier to stay as we are, pretty much, than it is to develop a new version of ourselves. And even if we don't feel that we're the way we want to be, we still know what it is. And that sort of feeling of familiarity and comfort can make us very comfortable with not changing and find change very, very stressful, even if it's in the direction that we want. And I think that's one of the great benefits of PCP, that it does help us to understand when things don't go the way that we expect and how stressful they can be, even if that seemed to be something that would make sense to us. Another thing that can happen with the estimate of efficacy is it can be invalidated, leading to guilt where the outcome becomes more common. So he goes on to say, guilt from a personal construct theory outlook is the individual's recognition of a need to alter the way he views himself. It may appear as a surprise following an unexpected outcome. Thus, an opening batsman with a run of low scores may feel he has let himself down by performing consistently below his expectation. He may construe it as a loss of form, which may consequently lead to a lack of belief in his ability. On the other hand, a gymnast who perfects a vault after many previous failed attempts may experience guilt in the form of having to reevaluate his belief in being able to master the move. So that we might feel very uncomfortable with this change that we see in ourselves and have to sort of explain it away because it's not like us. So guilt is about that kind of experience of, this isn't me, this isn't the real me, or this is not the true me in some kind of way. Another thing that I found very interesting in this book is the thought of rituals and how they can be part of pre-competition behaviour. So what they do, according to Butler, is they remain constant and they generate a sense of control. So I was watching the tennis and Nadal has a particular ritual that he goes through just before he takes a serve. And it's pretty much always the same. It looks really superstitious. Butler says rituals are the expression of superstitions. A superstition is a belief that a certain way of acting will produce a desired result. Thus, kit bags are packed in particular ways. Getting changed is undertaken in a specific sequence. Lucky attire is worn. Driving a distinct route to the ground becomes the norm. Eating a specific meal before playing, all are embarked on because sometime in the past such an action became associated with a successful performance or outcome. A ritual is the routine or behaviour an athlete goes through to satisfy the superstition. When a ritual is followed by a good performance, the superstition is validated, thus increasing the likelihood that the athlete will act in that way in the future. Even a series of poor performances will often not invalidate the superstition because the belief is held so strongly. Sometimes the ritual will even increase following a poor performance because the athlete may attribute the poor performance to inefficient undertaking of the ritual, therefore vowing to ensure the ritual is better executed during the next performance. Rituals can be construed as providing structure, much like a pre-competition plan in the face of uncertainty. As such, they may be perceived as ways of establishing control during preparation and can further act as time markers as the competition approaches. So you may have a ritual that is kind of cueing you in to the competition or the session that you're having in your sport. So you could be playing five-a-side football. So you might have the same way of getting ready for that five-a-side football game every single week. And if you don't do it that way, you might feel a bit uncomfortable. And if you think about these kind of superstitions as a way of trying to have control in your performance, it's actually quite helpful. So you can think, okay, I mean, I tend to bounce the ball before I serve. Not because I think it makes any difference, but to me, I'm just kind of cueing myself in to say, I'm going to serve in a minute. I haven't got the kind of ritual Nadal's got, thank goodness, because that would take too long for me. He does it very quickly and almost unnoticeably at times. But these little rituals that we might have will help us to feel a sense of control in a situation that lacks control and that, but we want a particular outcome. So we're trying to have control in it. So any ways that we can find that we'll do that might increase our sense of control. So if you want to help other people to develop their confidence in a sport, what kind of things can you do? So Butler talks about how you can improve people's confidence. And the evidence is that there are certain techniques that can be used. And there is a nice little table of that, which I think would apply to any activity. So I'll put a picture of the table in the show notes, I hope, or at least a link to it. But these are the things that are included in it. So one way to improve people's confidence is praise. And this is found to be best delivered with emphasis, genuinely directed, and immediately following a successful attempt or accomplishment. So it's got to be straight away, and it's got to point out what worked. Feedback, which is the immediate relaying of information about performance, either of an objective nature or subjectively. So an objective nature is time, and subjectively is commenting on improved performance. So objectively might be telling somebody how quick they were at that particular race. And that happens in the park runs, that everybody gets to know their time. Or subjectively, which is where you comment on a particular improved technique. So you might notice that somebody is taking longer strides and that's helping them. Another thing would be some positive statements. So emphasizing the athlete's qualities and attributes as perceived by the coach, psychologist or support staff. Working on strengths. So fine-tuning techniques that the athlete is particularly adept at. So they're already able to do something and you're then going to hone those skills even more. Encouraging self-statements. So inviting the athlete to remind himself of his strengths and abilities. Verbal persuasion, which is coaching, enticing, persuading the athlete that he's capable and able to perform successfully. And I think that's the most obvious one, you know, saying to people, come on, you can do it. That's great. You've done it before. Framing things positively. So delivering instructions in a way that does not allude to what is not expected. So don't say, what not to do. So don't say, if it's tennis, don't stay on the baseline. You need to say, move forward. Because I guess, you know, in terms of the actual information being received, the negative is more difficult to understand than the positive. So anything that can be expressed in a positive way should be done that way if you want to improve people's performance. I mean, unless you do that, what you're asking the person to do is consider both poles of the construct and work out where to move to on it. So if you say, you know, don't stay at the baseline, move forward, that will mean that they have to consider both. What you want to do really is elaborate their construing of the moving forward so that that becomes something that they do much more automatically. Telling them what not to do isn't particularly helpful. Another thing that can be helpful is analysing performance, so some kind of evaluation of the performance. And nowadays that can be on video, but it can also be of, you know, looking at graphs of times if you're trying to do racing things, thinking how many serves you got in, which I try and make myself remember, but I'm not very good at it. So noticing your own performance, but somebody else pointing those things out to you is really helpful because you have a lot to notice if you are the athlete. Encouraging reflection, so encouraging an athlete to assess his performance, particularly following success. Again, that's about increasing the likelihood that success recurs. You don't necessarily have to do that in as much detail, probably, as if you have a failure. Visualizing, and there's been lots of research about how important visualizing is. So picturing yourself having a successful performance is really important. And actually, you know, in terms of the neuroscience, has a huge effect on how the brain operates. So it becomes a more familiar thing. And I know David Beckham used to take loads and loads and loads of free kicks every day in training when everyone else had gone. And you can see the benefit of that. So emphasising advantages, focusing on the athlete's superiority or perceived edge. That can be helpful. Focusing on the performance, which he says is the behaviours exhibited by the athlete which accounted for the success, not the success itself. So not the fact that they win, but what they did that helped them to win. Now that would be the same with something like reading. You know, that if you're encouraging a child to read, you don't want to just finish the books. You want them to read it more fluently and point out that they read it more fluently and that reading that book seemed to be easier for them than it used to be. Emphasizing readiness, so stressing how well an athlete has prepared and emphasizing that any arousal is a signal of the athlete's preparedness to compete. I think that's quite interesting. So, you know, that might involve a kind of reappraisal of stress. So instead of seeing it as, you know, my heart's beating really fast, I need to calm down so I'll be able to perform well, you might talk about that in terms of, okay, your heart was already racing, ready so that you could perform. And then lastly, expecting success. So providing an expectation of success because of the athlete's previous successful performances and because no stone has been left unturned in the preparation. I think the book is it's a very easy read book and it's quite thorough, covering lots of different angles. So if you are somebody who does a sport and wants to improve, you may want to get it for yourself. Or if you're working with other people in that capacity where you're trying to help them improve their performance. But I would definitely argue that actually you could read this book and think about performance in anything. It's not only specific to sport. And that's often the case with things that are PCP, you know, that it will be transferable quite easily to anything. So it's a good book on coaching. You might find you can't get it very easily, except secondhand. I think it's out of print. But you can get it secondhand. It is around. So I would tend to look on Amazon for things like that because they will list all the bookstores around the country that have second-hand copies. Okay, so the anticipation of any performance for my tennis when I play tomorrow, I'll see what happens. And having read this book, I'm thinking about it slightly differently already. The kind of self-coaching, you know, the way that I talk to myself about playing tennis is gradually changing because I'm noticing different things. And there are some things that I know aren't very much use to me. And that's some progress, at least. I might not be able to hit the ball, but I can think about it. So there we go. That's something. Thanks for listening, and I'll speak to you again in August. Bye.